That was unnecessary, Goal, the horseman said. Wait outside. She spoke without permission. If she fails to show the proper respect, you may teach her some manners. Now go, ordered the horseman.
I struggled to my feet again. Goal left, but the other two guards remained by the door.
By now my patience was gone.
If I were quick enough, I might be able to wrap the foot of chain hanging between my wrists around the horseman's neck.
As I was gauging the distance, the horseman said, I wouldn't try anything stupid. He lifted a long broadsword from his lap.
Who the hell are you and what do you want?
I demanded. Watch your language or I'll call Goal back, he replied with a smile.
Go ahead, call him back. Take my manacles off and let us have a fair fight. When he didn't reply, I added, Guess you're afraid I'd win.
Typical ambusher mentality.
He looked at Leaf in amazement. Leaf stared back with concern, and I wondered what had gone on between them. Friends or foes?
You failed to mention this bravado.
Of course, he turned back to me. It could all be an act.
Try me, I said.
The horseman laughed. Despite his full blonde beard and mustache, he still looked younger than I. Maybe 17 or 18 years old. His eyes were a washed-out blue, and his shoulder-length blonde hair had been pulled back into a ponytail. He wore a simple light gray tunic. Even from this distance, I could tell that his shirt's fabric was finer than the guard's clothes. What do you want? I asked again.
Information.
I gaped at his unexpected answer.
Oh, come on, he said. Don't play the simpleton with me. I want military statistics on Ixia. Troop size and location. Strengths. Weaknesses. How many weapons. Valak's precise location. Who and where his other spies are. That type of information.
Why would you think I know all this? He glanced at Leaf, and sudden understanding flooded my mind. You think I'm a northern spy? I sighed. Leaf had set me up.
That's why the horseman knew Leaf was my brother. Leaf's fear and shock during the ambush had all been an act. He had no business with the first magician. No wonder he hadn't said a word since I had arrived in the tent.
All right. Since everyone believes I'm a spy, I guess I should act like one.
I crossed my arms to achieve a defiant posture. The clang of the manacles didn't help the image, but I sallied forth anyway. I'm not telling you southern scum anything.
You'll have no choice.
Then you're in for a surprise.
Meaning I didn't have the answers he sought. If he had wanted to know the commander's favorite food, I'd be happy to oblige.
I could have Goal torture the information out of you, he said. He would enjoy that. But that's rather messy and time-consuming. And I always consider facts divulged under stress to be suspect.
The horseman rose from his chair and walked around the table, coming closer to me.
He clutched his sword in his right hand, trying to be intimidating. He was about 7 inches taller than me, and he had tucked his dark gray pants into knee-high black leather riding boots.
You're the one in for a surprise, because I'm going to bring you to the magician's keep where first magician will peel your mind like a banana, exposing the soft center where all the answers lie. Your brain gets a little mashed in the process.
He shrugged his shoulders as if unconcerned about this detail.
But the information is always accurate.
Real fear brushed my skin for the first time since I had awakened a prisoner.
Perhaps I'd made a mistake in playing the spy. I don't suppose you would believe me if I said I didn't have what you wanted? The horseman shook his head.
The proof of your loyalties is in your backpack. Ixian coins and your northern uniform.
Which really proves I'm not a spy, because Valak would never recruit someone stupid enough to carry her uniform on a mission, I said in frustration,
but regretted having mentioned Valak's name.
She just gave herself away, look, flashed between the horseman and Leaf.
I tried to stall for time.
Who are you, and why do you want this information?
I'm King Cahill Ixia, and I want my throne.
Chapter 6
King of Ixia? This young idiot was claiming to be a king?
The King of Ixia is dead, I said.
I'm well aware that your boss, Valak, murdered the king and all his family when Commander Ambrose took control of Ixia. But he made what will soon prove to be a fatal mistake.
Cahill jabbed his sword into the air.
He didn't count the bodies. And the king's 6-year-old nephew was smuggled to the south. I'm the heir to the Ixion throne, and I plan to claim it.
You'll need more men, I said.
How many more? He asked with considerable interest.
More than 12. My best guess of the number of men in the camp. He laughed.
Don't worry. The commander's military and corps of assassins are enough of a threat to Cydia to provide me with plenty of followers. Besides, he thought for a moment, once I deliver you to the Citadel and show them that I've uncovered a dangerous spy, they'll have no choice but to support my campaign against Ambrose. I'll have the whole Cytian army at my command.
He failed to impress me. Instead, he reminded me of a boy playing with toy soldiers. I did a quick mental calculation. Cahill was a year older than me, making him 21. So you're taking me to the Citadel? I asked. He nodded.
There, First Magician will reap the information from your mind.
He smiled as a greedy glint sparked in his eyes. Somehow, I had missed the connection of the magician and the Citadel the first time Cahill had mentioned it. The reference to them mashing my brains must have thrown me off. I'm going to the Citadel anyway. Why all the trouble? I unfolded my arms, showing the manacles.
You are masquerading as a student. Unfortunately, the magicians take their ethical code very serious and won't interrogate you unless you're caught doing something illegal. Without my intervention, they would have invited you in and taught you all the secrets of Cydia.
So I was to be his proof. He wanted to show them that he had saved the Cytians from a menacing criminal. Okay, I'll go with you to the Citadel, I offered my wrists. Remove these, and I won't give you any trouble.
And what's to stop you from running off? He asked.
There was a hitch of disbelief in his voice.
My word.
Your word means nothing, Leif said.
His first verbalization of the night, and I felt a strong urge to quiet him with my fist. I stared at him, beaming the promise of a future confrontation. Cahill appeared unconvinced.
How about the 12 men you have guarding me? I asked.
No. You're my prisoner. You should be dressed as such.
Cahill waved his hand, and the two guards by the tent's entrance grabbed my arms. Meeting over. I was dragged from the tent and dumped by the fire, where Gol resumed his hawk-like guard. Cahill had left me no choice. I would not arrive at the Citadel as his prize. I lay there, watching and listening to the men as a simple plan formed in my mind. When the camp settled in for the night, two men relieved Gol. I feigned sleep, waiting until the second shift of men had enough time to grow bored. Magic was the only weapon I had left, yet I was uncertain of my strength and abilities. What I planned to do could be considered a direct violation of the magician's ethical code, but at this point I didn't care. I would have preferred to fight, but I was out of options and time. Breathing deep, I tried to project my awareness out. Without the aid of my bow, I failed miserably. I couldn't focus. Not wanting to risk any big movements, I rubbed my thumbs along my fingertips. The skin contact helped to center my mind until I could push it away from me. I had hoped my guards would be drowsy, but one whistled under his breath, and the other reviewed military tactics in his head, although I could feel the desire for sleep pulling at their minds. I used that desire. I gave a mental command to sleep and crossed my fingers. My knowledge of magic was very limited. I had no idea if it would work. At first, resistance pushed back. I tried again. Soon, the two men sank to the ground, but still remained awake. I had wanted to be subtle, but the night was running out.
Sleep, I ordered with force, and they fell over.
The chains clanked when I sat up. Pressing them to my beating chest, I scanned the slumbering men. I had forgotten about the noise. Since I could only use one hand and my mouth, picking the manacles' locks would be difficult and loud, so I revised my plan. Perhaps I could send all the men into a deep sleep where noise would not rouse them. I projected my awareness, touching each man's mind, putting them into a heavy, dreamless slumber. Cahill slept on a cot in the tent. While I would have enjoyed rifling through his mind, I settled for sending him into an unconscious state. Leif's magical protection prevented me from affecting him. I hoped he was a heavy sleeper.
working with my diamond pick in one hand and with the tension wrench between my teeth. I managed to pop the locks on my wrist manacles after a fifth attempt. The sky began to brighten a shade. My time was slipping away. I crept into the tent to retrieve my backpack, stuffing my belongings into it. I made more noise than I wanted, but my instincts told me that full dawn would waken the men.
As I fled, I grabbed my bow from beside the guard who had claimed it.
Running through the forest, I noticed that the darkness faded with every stride. My thoughts turned sluggish, and I huffed for breath as weakness pulled at my legs. Using magic on the men had drained my energy.
I scanned the treetops, looking for a big leaf variety with lots of branches.
Spotting a tree with potential, I halted and took my grapple and rope from my backpack.
By the time I managed to hook a branch, my arms felt like rubber.
I had to smile at the irony of my situation, though, as I pulled myself up the rope. This was the third time I had used the treetops for escape, and the climb was becoming almost routine. But the distant shouts of angry men spurred me on. When I reached the top, I reeled in my rope, and then scrambled to a higher limb for more cover. I wrapped Fern's green cloth around me as I sat with my back to the trunk, my knees drawn to my chest. Leaving a gap to see through, I settled in for a long wait. I hoped my strength would return soon.
Hearing a commotion, I imagined the scene going on at Cahill's camp. The reprimand of the guards who fell asleep during their watch. The discovery that my backpack and effects were missing.
I trusted that made Cahill pause, knowing that I had stood only a few feet from him and let him live.
My position in the tree was closer to the camp than I had wanted. Searchers with drawn swords came into view sooner than I had anticipated.
I froze in my green cocoon.
Goal led the men.
He stooped to inspect a bush and then called,
"This way. She's not far. The sap's still sticky."
Rivers of sweat ran down my skin. Goal was a tracker. I moved my hand, finding the slit in my pants. My switchblade hadn't been confiscated. Grabbing the smooth wood of the handle made me feel a bit better. He stopped at the bottom of my tree. I shifted my weight forward and crouched on the branch, preparing to flee if needed.
Goal examined the ground around the base of the trunk.
His eyes slid up into the branches.
My breath locked as cold fear splashed through me. I realized I had made a grave mistake. A predatory smile spread across Goal's lips.
"Found you."
Chapter 7. I yanked my forest camouflage off my back and shook the material out like a sheet.
"There she is," one of Goal's men cried out, pointing up at me.
Releasing the fabric, I let it float down toward the men.
The second the material obscured their view, I launched myself through the treetops, scrambling with a sudden spur of energy from branch to branch in an effort to get myself higher and farther from Goal and his men.
"Hey!" someone yelled from below.
"Stop her!"
I kept moving, hoping that Goal couldn't track me through the trees. My mistake had been to forget that Cahill had searched through my backpack.
He knew I carried a grapple and rope. With a good tracker and the hint of my trick, it hadn't taken them long to find me. Curses and yelling followed below me. I focused all my efforts on finding branches that would hold my weight and getting away. Once my mind calmed enough for rational thought, I realized I was making a racket. Goal and his men could track me by listening to the rattle of the leaves and the snapping of branches. All they had to do then was wait for me to fall or exhaust myself. Once I slowed down, taking care not to make any noise, I could hear the men on the forest floor. They called my position to each other, closing in.
"Hold up," a voice said right below me.
My muscles jerked in shock.
"She stopped."
I kept climbing. My progress was a nerve-wracking snail's pace, but quiet.
"We have you," Goal called. "Come down now, and I'll only hurt you a little."
I bit back a sarcastic reply to his generous offer.
Instead, I continued to move through the trees. The men remained silent, and soon I had no idea where they were.
I paused on an upper branch to search for some sign of them, but saw nothing but a sea of green leaves.
Then my imagination kicked in. I felt trapped. My face burned with the sudden belief that Gol's eyes were on me. Panic pumped in my heart until I remembered the instruction Iris had given me back in the jungle. Seek with your mind, not with your eyes. Using my magic still wasn't instinctive. Taking a deep breath, I pulled my bow, concentrated on the smooth wood against my fingers, and projected my awareness down to the forest floor. The men had spread out. They searched a wide area to my right. I couldn't sense Gol below. With a sick feeling crawling along my skin, I swept the treetops. Gol had climbed into the canopy. He followed the trail I had left in my haste. Black thoughts of inflicting pain colored his mind. When he reached the place where I had begun to travel with more care, I waited. He hesitated for a heartbeat, but spotted another sign, continuing on toward my location. It was only a matter of time before Gol found me. I considered using my magic to force him off my trail. Could I make him fall asleep? Probably, but Gol would eventually wake up and track me down. I could try prompting him into forgetting who he searched for, but for that I would need to delve deep into his mind, and such an effort would drain my remaining strength. Think. I had to take Gol out. Unless Cahill had another tracker, my chances of escaping improved without Gol on my tail. A plan began to form in my mind. I slid my bow back through its holder on my pack. Keeping light contact with Gol's mind, I picked up the pace and continued on my route for a while, making sure to leave a trail. When I reached a small clearing in the forest, I swung down to the ground, landing with a hard jolt. Leaving nice deep boot prints, I walked across the clearing and broke through the underbrush on the other side. Now came the hard part. Retracing my path, I returned to the tree from which I had jumped. The grapple would leave marks, so I used it to throw the rope over the tree branch, and then I shimmied up. Hopefully, the rub marks on the branch would make it appear that I had gone down to the clearing, not up. Then I looped the rope and hung it around my shoulder and torso so my hands were free. Gol was now close enough to hear me. I made a small grunt like I had hit the ground hard. With the utmost care, I climbed higher in the tree. Gol came into sight. I froze. He inspected the branch I had used to drop into the clearing. He leaned over and peered at the forest floor.
"So me prey has gone to ground," Gol said to himself.
He swung down and crouched by my marks. His thoughts focused on how much he would enjoy torturing me. "Sleep," I projected into his mind. "Sleep." But he was wide awake, and the command raised immediate suspicions. He stood and glanced around the clearing. Damn, that wasn't working. "Don't look up," I projected as I moved to a lower branch. The leaves shook, but Gol didn't notice. Triggering my switchblade, I cut a 3-foot section of rope. I wrapped the ends around my hands as Gol turned back to examine my tracks. I jumped, landing behind him. Before he could move, I looped the rope I held around his throat. I spun. My backpack touched his back, and the rope was now over my shoulder. I dropped to one knee, forcing Gol to bend backward over me. In that position, only his fingertips could reach me. Instead, he yanked at the garrot around his neck. Just when I thought he was unconscious, his head bumped mine, and I felt his full weight on my back. He did a backward somersault over me. I saw his boots hit the ground in front of me. Damn! Gol knew some self-defense techniques. He straightened and wrenched the rope right out of my hands.
"Got anything else?"
he asked, his voice rasped from my strangulation attempt. I pulled my bow from my back. He drew his sword. He smiled.
"Little girl. Little weapon."
Gol pointed to himself.
"Big man. Big weapon."
I shifted into a fighting stance, balancing my weight on the balls of my feet. He wasn't going to intimidate me. If I could disarm my friend Ari, who had twice Gol's muscle mass, and Ari's partner, Janko, who was rabbit fast, I could take on Gol. Sliding my hands along the wood of my weapon, I reestablished my mental link with Gol. When he lunged, I knew it before he moved. I stepped to the side, turning sideways so his sword missed my stomach. In a stride, I was in close. I slammed my bow into his temple. He crumpled to the ground, unconscious. Thanking fate that Gol hadn't called for his men, I searched his pack.
I found brass knuckles, a small whip, a black club, an assortment of knives,
a gag, manacles, keys,
and my camouflage material.
If I killed Gol, I would be doing the South a favor.
A shame that Gol's death wouldn't go well in my I'm-not-a-spy defense. So I dragged him to a tree and propped him into a sitting position against the trunk. The manacles had just enough chain for me to lock his hands behind the tree. I shoved his gag into his mouth, fastening the strap around his head. I took my camouflage material and the manacles' keys from his pack. Then I hid his pack and sword in the bushes.
Pausing a moment to regain my focus, I sought Gol's men with my mind.
Satisfied that they were far enough away, I mentally scanned the forest for Cahill's campsite. Once I knew in which direction to go, I set out. I couldn't leave Gol to die. Yet if I released him, he would only track me down. I could find someone to direct me to the Citadel and hope the few hours it took Cahill to find Gol would be enough time for me to stay ahead of them. That had been my intent when I had first escaped. But now that rankled. It would be the actions of a criminal or a spy, and I wasn't guilty. I wouldn't run away. Perhaps I could use my magic and trick Gol into losing my trail. Then I could follow Cahill, keeping a close eye on him. But would he continue to the Citadel without me as his prisoner? I didn't know. A sudden intense desire for Valak was swept through my body. Discussing military tactics with him had always helped me work out a problem. I thought about how Valak would handle this situation. And, soon after, a rough plan formed.
"You lost her,"
Cahill repeated. He frowned as he stared at the faces of the four unhappy men who stood in front of him.
"Where's Gol?" he asked.
A mumbled reply.
"You lost him, too?"
Outrage gripped Cahill's face. The men cringed and stammered. I suppressed the urge to laugh out loud. My position near his campsite afforded me a clear view of Cahill and his men, while I remained hidden under my camouflage. I had used the waning daylight and the clamor of the search party's arrival to move closer to the clearing.
"You're a bunch of bumbling fools. Searching a prisoner for weapons and anything that would help an escape is standard procedure."
Cahill glared at his men.
"A complete and thorough search. You don't stop because you found one weapon."
Cahill stared at his men until they fidgeted.
"Captain Merrick?"
"Yes, my lord."
Merrick snapped to attention.
"If Gol doesn't return by first light, I want you to lead a search party to find him. He's our best chance of recovering that spy," Cahill ordered.
"Yes, sir."
Cahill stalked off to his tent. When he was gone, I could see the grim faces of his men as they stood around the campfire. The smell of roasting meat made my stomach complain. I hadn't eaten all day, but I couldn't risk making any noise. With a sigh, I squirmed into a comfortable position, settling in for a long wait. Keeping alert proved difficult once the men had gone to sleep. Captain Merrick posted two guards who circled the campsite. Using magic had drained me, and I fought my heavy eyelids until I gave up and dozed for a while. The dream image of Gol's hands on my neck jerked me awake in the middle of the night. The guards were on the far side of the camp. I used my magic to send the sleeping men into a deeper slumber. The guards, though, fought hard. The image of the harsh punishment their comrades had received for falling asleep on guard duty the night before kept them vigilant. So I tried the "don't look" command as I crept toward Cahill's tent. Upon reaching the back wall of the tent, I triggered my switchblade and cut a slit in the fabric. Then I entered the tent through that small opening. Cahill was asleep. Leaf looked like he hadn't heard my entrance. Curled up on his side with one arm dangling over the edge of the cot, he appeared to be sleeping. Cahill lay on his back, his arms crossed over his stomach. His long sword rested on the floor within Cahill's reach. I moved the weapon away before I sat on his chest. The instant he awoke, I had my blade pressed against his throat.
"Quiet, or I'll kill you," I whispered.
His eyes widened. He tried to move his arms, but my weight pinned them down. Cahill could muscle me off, but I pushed the blade's point into his skin. A drop of blood welled. "Don't move,"
I said. Your sword is out of reach. I'm not that stupid.
So I'm learning, he whispered.
I felt him relax.
What do you want?
Cahill asked. A truce.
What kind?
You stop trying to drag me to the Citadel in chains, and I'll accompany you there as a fellow traveler.
What do I get out of the deal?
You get Goal back, and my cooperation.
You have Goal?
I dangled the manacle's keys over his face.
How can I trust you when your brother doesn't trust you?
I'm offering a truce. So far, I've had two opportunities to kill you. You're a real threat to Ixia. If I were a true spy, your death would make me famous in the North.
And if I renege on this truce?
I shrugged. I'll escape again. But this time, I'll leave Gol's dead body behind.
He's a good tracker, Cahill said with pride.
Unfortunately.
If I say no to your offer?
Then I'm gone, leaving you to find Goal.
Dead?
Yes, I bluffed.
Why come back? You took care of Goal. He was the only threat to you.
Because I want the chance to prove that I'm not a spy, I said with frustration. I'm a Zoltana, and I'm not going to run like a criminal because I'm not guilty. But I don't want to be your prisoner. And I couldn't explain anymore. I sighed. He was right. If my own brother didn't trust me, why should Cahill? I had gambled and lost. Time for Plan B. I would run. My safest course would be to find Iris. I withdrew my switchblade from Cahill's throat. After a full day on the lam without food or sleep, a bone-deep fatigue overcame me. I jumped off of Cahill. I'm not going to kill anybody. I backed toward the slit I had cut in the tent, keeping my eyes on Cahill. When I turned to find the rip in the fabric, a sudden wave of dizziness overcame me, and I stumbled to the ground. The tent spun, and I lost consciousness for a mere moment as all my energy fled. I regained my wits in time to see Cahill pick up my switchblade. Chapter 8 Cahill moved away and lit the lantern on his bedside table. He examined my switchblade in the candlelight.
My lord? A voice called through the door.
I braced myself, preparing to be accosted and manacled by a rush of guards.
Everything's fine, Cahill called.
Very good, sir.
I heard the guard move away, and I looked at Cahill in surprise. Perhaps he wanted me to tell him where Goal was before he reclaimed me. I sat up and glanced at Leif. His eyes were closed, but I didn't know if the light and Cahill's voice had roused him.
These markings are very familiar, Cahill said, referring to the six symbols engraved on the handle of my switchblade. My uncle's secret battle codes, I believe.
His gaze returned to me. His sleep-tousled hair reinforced my first impression of his youth, but a sharp intelligence danced in his eyes. I nodded. The codes had been used by the King of Ixia to send secret messages to his captains during battles.
It's been so long, Cahill said.
A brief sadness pulled at his face.
What do they mean?
It says, sieges weathered, fight together, friends forever. It was a gift.
Someone in the north?
Loneliness touched my heart as I thought of what I had lost by coming south. My fingers sought the lump under my shirt, Valak's butterfly. Yes.
Who?
An odd question. Why would he care? I searched Cahill's face for some sign of duplicity and found only curiosity. Janko, one of my self-defense teachers. I grinned at the memories of Janko singing his rhymes and knocking aside my attacks. Without him and Ari, I wouldn't have had the skills to escape you and take on Goal today.
They taught you well.
Cahill ran a hand along his neck, smearing the drop of blood. He seemed deep in thought as he turned my switchblade in his hands. He pushed the blade into the handle, then triggered it. The snick from the weapon made me flinch.
Well made, he said.
Cahill stepped toward me. I scrambled upright and stood in a defensive stance. Even though I was light-headed and weak, I contemplated my chances of getting away. Instead of threatening me, Cahill retracted the blade and gave me the switchblade. I looked at the weapon in my hand with a tired astonishment.
A truce, then, he said. But any trouble and I'll have you in chains.
Cahill gestured to a corner of the tent.
You're exhausted. Get some sleep. We have a long day tomorrow.
Placing his sword back within reach, Cahill lay down on his cot.
Do you want to know where Gol is? I asked.
Is he in any immediate danger?
Unless there are poisonous or predatory animals in this forest.
Then let him sweat out the night. Serves him right for being caught.
Cahill closed his eyes. I glanced around the tent. Leif hadn't moved since I had arrived, but his eyes were open. He made no comment as he rolled over to his other side, turning his back on me. Again. I sighed, wondering how much he had heard, and found I was too tired to care. With weariness dragging at my limbs, I spread my cloak on the floor, blew out the lantern, and collapsed on my makeshift bed. The next morning, Leif left the tent without saying a word. Cahill told me to stay inside while he made a show of the fact that Gol hadn't returned. I heard Cahill question the guards of the previous night.
All was quiet, my lord, one man replied.
Nothing unusual? Cahill asked.
Just your light, sir. But you said...
What if I'd had a knife at my throat, Errant? Would you have believed what I said?
No, sir.
How did you know, then, that I wasn't in trouble?
I didn't, sir. I should have checked, Errant said, sounding miserable.
Should-haves lead to death. In war, you don't get a second chance. In a battle with the North, they won't send an army against us. They'll send one man. Without vigilance, we'll all be killed in our sleep.
Someone scoffed.
Surely one man can't get by us.
How about a woman? Cahill asked.
No way, a guard said amid cheers of assent.
Then explain this.
Yelena?
Cahill called. An immediate silence filled the forest.
Join me, please.
I didn't like being part of Cahill's lesson, but he was right. An assassin trained by Valak would have had no trouble taking out his guards. I stepped from the tent, holding my bow in case anyone decided to rush me. The morning sun shone in my eyes as I squinted to examine Cahill's men. Surprise, anger, and disbelief peppered their faces. Captain Marek drew his sword. Leif was nowhere in sight.
Everything wasn't fine last night, Errant, Cahill said. Next time, make sure.
Errant hung his head.
Yes, sir.
Yelena will be traveling with us to the Citadel.
Treat her as a comrade, Cahill ordered. What about Gol? Asked Captain Marek.
Cahill looked at me.
Tell him where Gol is.
You'll keep Gol on a leash? I asked. There was no doubt in my mind that Gol's desire for revenge would cause trouble. I shuddered at the thought of being at his mercy.
Captain Marek, explain the situation to Gol. Before you free him, make sure he gives his word not to harm Yelena.
Yes, sir.
Unless I give him permission, Cahill added, staring at me, trouble will get you in chains. Treason will get you Gol.
A rumble of appreciation rolled through Cahill's men. His little show had earned him points in their minds. I gave him a bored look. I had been threatened many times before and had learned that the men who didn't make verbal threats were the most dangerous. With that thought, I searched the campsite for Leif. Perhaps he had returned home now that I had delivered myself to Cahill. I gave Marek the key to the manacles and instructions as to where to find Gol and his pack. As the captain left to free him, the rest of the guards began breaking down the campsite. Cahill's men kept a wary eye on me. A couple of hostile glares were thrown my way, especially when they discovered the rip in the tent's fabric. While waiting for the captain and Gol to return, I sorted and organized my backpack. I combed and braided my hair, then twisted the long braid up into a bun, using my lockpicks to hold the hair in place. It never hurt to be prepared. Cahill might trust me not to cause trouble, but he still believed I was a northern spy. Gol returned with Marek and Leif. I was surprised to see Leif, but not surprised by the seething glower on Gol's face. His cheeks had deep red marks where the gag strap had pressed into his skin. His hair and clothes were unkempt. Wetness stained his pants, and his skin was blotchy from multiple mosquito bites. Gol gripped his sword, starting toward me. Captain Marek intercepted Gol and pointed across the clearing to a bedroll still lying on the ground.
Goal sheathed his sword and headed to the sleeping mat, shooting me a look of venom. I resumed breathing. Once the camp was packed, Cahill mounted his horse and led us to the forest trail. I stayed close to Merrick in case Goal forgot his promise again.
The captain grinned at me and said, "Watch now."
Cahill clicked at his horse as he tapped his heels into the animal's sides. The horse increased its stride, and the men began to jog.
"Keep up," Merrick said.
I hadn't run laps since training with Ari and Janko, but I had found some time to exercise while traveling south. Matching Merrick's pace, I asked, "Why does he make you run?"
"Keeps us battle ready."
I had more questions, but I saved my breath, concentrating instead on staying with Merrick. By the time we reached the next campsite, my field of vision had shrunk to a small area on the captain's back. My efforts to stay in shape hadn't been enough. When we stopped, I labored for air, sucking in huge mouthfuls. Leaf, too, seemed winded. "Hasn't run with his friends for a while," I thought peevishly. Once the camp was erected, Cahill offered to let me sleep in the corner of his tent again. There, I collapsed to the ground without bothering to spread my cloak. In the morning, I ate a light breakfast. The next 3 days mirrored the first day of traveling with Cahill, but by the end of the fourth day, I wasn't as exhausted. I could eat dinner, and even stayed by the fire for a while. Goal glared at me whenever I met his eye, so I ignored him. Leaf pretended I didn't exist. I began to think the forest was endless. Day after day we covered many miles, yet met no one on the trail, nor saw any sign of a village. I suspected Cahill avoided the towns. I couldn't be sure if it was for my benefit or his. Eventually, the men got used to my presence. They bantered and kidded with each other and practiced sword fighting. The wary glances disappeared, and my arrival at the campfire no longer caused an immediate hush. I found it interesting that the men always sought Captain Merrick's approval prior to doing anything. After we'd been traveling for 7 days, Captain Merrick surprised me. Some of the guards were performing self-defense drills, and he invited me to join them.
"We could use the practice against that staff of yours," he said.
I agreed, showing the men some basic defense moves with my bow. While they used their wooden swords, I demonstrated the advantages of having a longer weapon. My participation in the practice drew Cahill's attention. He usually showed no interest in the training sessions, preferring instead to talk to Leaf about his quest to conquer Ixia. But now he approached to watch.
"Wood against wood is fine for practice, but wood against steel is no contest in a real fight," Cahill said. "A sharp sword would reduce that staff to splinters."
"The edges are the sword's danger zone. The trick is to avoid the edges," I said.
"Show me."
Cahill drew his sword. The thick blade extended about 3.5 feet from the hilt. An impressive weapon, but heavy. Cahill would need 2 hands to wield it, slowing him down. I concentrated on the feel of the bow's wood in my hands, setting my mind into my mental fighting zone. He lunged forward. Surprised by his quickness, I jumped back. Cahill held the sword one-handed, and I found myself on the defensive. He had some skill with his weapon, but not much. When he swung the massive blade, I dodged, stepped in close, and struck the flat of his sword with my bow. The next time he swung, I hit his hand. When he lunged, I kept my bow horizontal and brought it down on the flat tip of the blade, deflecting the weapon toward the ground. My counter-strikes wouldn't disarm him, but all the while I kept moving, forcing Cahill to chase me. When he grabbed his sword with both hands, I knew he was beginning to tire. It was just a matter of time before he made a tactical error. Our match lengthened. His men cheered for him, urging him to take me out. They didn't notice the sheen of sweat on Cahill's forehead or hear the rasp of his breath. Soon enough, he swung too wide. I ducked in close and tapped my bow on his ribs. "Have I proven my point?" I asked, dancing past his next attack. Cahill stopped.
"It's getting late. We'll have to finish this later," he said.
Sheathing his sword, he marched off to his tent. Practice was over. His men were quiet as they put away their equipment. I sat by the campfire, waiting until Cahill had a chance to cool down. Captain Merrick sat next to me.
"You proved your point," he said.
I shrugged. With a lighter sword, Cahill would have won.
We stared at the flames in silence.
Why does he carry that sword? I asked Merrick.
It was the king's. We managed to smuggle it south with Cahill.
I studied Merrick. His face had that worn leather look of a man who has been around for a long time and seen it all.
I realized his skin was tanned from the sun and wasn't a natural pigmentation.
You're from the north.
He nodded and gestured to the men.
We all are.
I studied the men. They were a mixed crew of dark and light-skinned. And I remembered that, before the takeover, the border between Ixia and Citia had been just a line on the map, and people from both countries mingled freely. Merrick continued.
We're the soldiers who weren't important enough to assassinate, nor willing to switch our loyalties to the commander. Goal, Trayton, Bronce, and I were all part of the king's guards.
Merrick shoved a twig into the fire. Sparks flew up into the night sky.
We couldn't save the king, but we saved his nephew. We raised him and taught him everything we know.
And? He stood.
We planned to give him a kingdom.
Merrick barked orders to the men and then headed to his bedroll. Weariness settled over me. My eyes grew heavy, and I dragged myself to my corner of the dark tent. Just before I fell asleep, the tent brightened. I felt a presence near me. My eyes snapped open. Cahill loomed over me with his sword in his hand. Anger pulsed from him in waves. Chapter 9. I stood slowly and stepped back from Cahill.
You humiliated me in front of my men, he said in anger.
You asked me to show you how a bow could defend against a sword. I was only doing what you wanted.
It wasn't an honest match.
What?
Leaf said you used magic during the fight, that you made me tired.
I suppressed my anger and looked Cahill straight in the eye.
I did not.
Then what did?
Do you really want to know why you lost? I asked.
Do you really have an answer?
He countered. You need to get off your horse and run with your men. You don't have the stamina for a long fight. And find a lighter sword.
But it was my uncle's.
You're not your uncle.
But I'm the king, and this is the king's sword, Cahill said.
His brows creased together. He seemed confused.
So wear it to your coronation, I said. If you use it in battle, you'll be wearing it to your funeral, I said.
You believe I'll be crowned?
That's not the point.
What is the point?
I would have beaten you with my bow. That sword is too heavy for you.
I always win against my men.
I sighed. Of course his men wouldn't beat him. I tried another tactic. Have you been in a battle?
Not yet. We're in training. And besides, a king doesn't risk himself during a battle. I stay in the base camp and direct the combat.
His comment didn't sound right to me. But then again, I had no experience with warfare. Instead, I said, Think about it, Cahill. Your men raised you. They want to reclaim the throne.
But do they want it for you, or for themselves? Exile in the south isn't as glamorous as being the king's guards.
Cahill snorted with disdain, shaking his head.
You know nothing. Why would you care? You're a spy. You're just trying to confuse me.
He returned to his cot. Cahill was right. I didn't care. Once we reached the keep and I proved my innocence, I wouldn't have to bother with him again. Leif, on the other hand, had interfered with me one too many times. I scanned the tent. My brother's cot was empty. Where's Leif? I asked.
Gone.
Where?
I sent him ahead to notify the keep of our arrival.
Why?
Family business. I spat the words out.
Cahill must have seen the murderous glint in my eyes.
You can't hurt him.
Oh, yes, I can. He's caused me a lot of trouble.
He has my protection.
Is that one of the benefits of being a member of your quest for the North?
No. When we captured you and Leif, I gave him my word that no harm would come to him in exchange for his full cooperation in dealing with you.
I blinked at Cahill. Had I heard him right?
But Leif set me up.
No, he didn't.
Why didn't you tell me before?
I thought letting you believe you had been betrayed by your own brother would demoralize you,
However, it seems to have had the opposite effect.
Cahill's plan might have worked if Leaf and I had had a relationship. I rubbed my face as I tried to decide if knowing the truth changed my opinion about Leaf. Sitting on the edge of his cot, Cahill studied me in silence. If Leaf didn't set me up, then who did?
Cahill smiled. I can't reveal my sources.
Leaf had managed to convince many Zoltanas that I was a spy, so the entire clan was suspect. Anyone at the Ilias Market could have overheard our destination as well. I couldn't worry about it now, but I wouldn't forget it either.
You said you sent Leaf to the keep, I said. Will we be there soon?
Tomorrow afternoon, about an hour after Leaf arrives. I want to make sure we're met by the right people, Cahill said. An important day, Yelena. Better get some sleep.
He blew out the lantern. I reclined on my cloak, wondering about the citadel and keep. Would Iris be there by tomorrow? Doubtful. I stretched my awareness out, seeking Iris but only encountering wildlife. Without Iris at the keep, would the first magician peel away the layers of my mind? Apprehension churned inside my stomach. I would rather face Goal than the unknown. Eventually, though, I slept. Dark dreams of Rayad swirled in my mind.
Same story, Yelena, Rayad's ghost said, laughing and taunting. No options. No friends. But you have a knife. Again.
An image of Rayad wrapped in blood-soaked sheets flashed in my dreams. The killing wound in his neck was the result of my desire to protect myself and the other kidnapped children from torture and mindless slavery.
Will you cut another's throat to save yourself?
He asked.
How about your own?
I woke to the sound of crying and realized with horror that my face was wet. Brushing away the tears, I resolved not to let my doubts plague me. Rayad's ghost might haunt my dreams, but I wouldn't allow him to haunt my life. Morning dawned with the smell of sweet cakes, and I joined the men by the fire for breakfast. After we ate, Cahill's men packed up the camp. Their mood was light and their banter friendly, so I was caught off guard when I felt a hand on my shoulder. Before I could move, the grip tightened, causing pain. I turned my head. Goal stood behind me. He dug his fingers deeper into my flesh as he whispered in my ear.
I promised not to hurt you while we travel to the citadel. Once there, you're mine.
I rammed my elbow into Gull's stomach. He grunted. I stepped forward and knocked his hand off my shoulder with my arm as I spun. Facing him, I asked, Why warn me? He drew in a deep breath and grinned.
Your anticipation will make the hunt more exciting.
Enough talk, Goal. Let's do it now.
No. I want time to play. I have all kinds of games planned for when I have you, my sweet.
My body shook with an icy chill of revulsion. Goosebumps covered my skin. It was a sensation I never thought I would feel in the sweltering south.
Goal, help take down the tent, Captain Marek ordered.
Yes, sir.
Goal walked away, glancing back at me with a smirk on his face and a promise in his eyes. I let my breath out slowly. This didn't bode well. When the men finished breaking camp, Cahill mounted his horse and we set off through the forest. After several hours, the trees thinned as the trail ascended a hill. At the top of the rise, a vast valley, bisected by a long dirt road, spread out in front of us. Farm fields etched geometric shapes on the left side of the road. An immense plain dominated the landscape on the right side. Across the vibrant valley was another ridge, and I could just make out a white fortress spanning its crest. Is that the citadel? I asked Marek. He nodded.
Another half day's march.
His gray eyes slid to the right as if searching for something. I followed his gaze and watched the long grass stalks sway in the breeze. Davian Plateau?
No, that's farther southeast, Marek said. This is the edge of the Avibian Plains. The plain is huge. It takes 10 days to cross it.
My cousin mentioned traveling through a plain on the way to the citadel, but we're really just skirting it.
Crossing Avibian is a shortcut.
Zoltana's will cross, but everyone else avoids contact with the Sandseed clan, who calls the plains home. Taking the forest route is the long way, but it's safe.
I wanted to ask more, but Cahill increased the pace as we descended into the basin. He was either eager to reach the citadel, or anxious to put the plains behind him. We passed laborers working in the farm fields, and a caravan of merchants with their horse-drawn wagons loaded with goods. Nothing but the tall grass moved in the plains. The citadel grew massive in appearance as we traveled closer. We stopped only once to water the horse and the men. When we reached the towering gates, I was awed by the sheer size of the outer bulwark. Green veins streaked the white marble walls. I ran a hand along them, finding it smooth and cool despite the blistering heat. I had thought it was hot in the forest, but that had been nothing compared to being fully exposed to the searing sun. The two guards at the citadel's open gates approached Cahill. After a brief conversation, Cahill led us into a courtyard. I squinted in the bright sunlight. The majestic sight before me took a while to sink in. An entire town resided within the citadel's outer walls. All the structures were made of the same white marble with veins of green that comprised the outer wall. I had visualized the citadel as one large building, like the commander's castle in Ixia, but this was far beyond anything I could have imagined.
"Impressed?" Merrick asked.
I closed my mouth and nodded. Our party began to walk through the streets, and I realized the place was deserted. "Where is everyone?" I asked Merrick.
"The citadel's a ghost town during the hot season. The council is in recess, the keep is on holiday, and only a skeleton crew tends the crops. Everyone who can flees to the cooler climates, and those who are left retreat inside at mid-afternoon to avoid the sun."
I didn't blame them. My scalp felt as if it were on fire. "How much longer?" I asked.
"Another hour," Merrick said. "See those four towers?"
He pointed to the east.
"That's the magician's keep."
I stared at their height, wondering what dwelled in those lofty chambers. We trudged on through the empty streets. The road surface alternated between packed dirt and cobblestones. I spotted dogs, cats, and a few chickens crouched in bits of shade. When we neared a large square structure with multiple tiers, Merrick said,
"That's Council Hall, where the Sishan government has its offices and conducts meetings."
The building had long steps that stretched the entire length beneath the first floor and led up to a grand entrance. Jade-colored columns bracketed the doorway. A group of people huddled in the hall's shadow. They approached us as we walked past. A strong odor of urine emanated from them. Filth matted their hair and covered their tattered attire. One man reached out with a soot-blackened hand.
"Please, sir, spare a coin?"
Cahill's men ignored them and kept walking. The group followed along, determined. "Who are—" I started to ask, but Merrick didn't slow. I tried to catch up, but a small boy pulled on my arm. His brown eyes were rimmed with sores, and streaks of dirt lined his cheeks. "Lovely lady, please. I'm hungry," the boy said. "Spare a copper?" I glanced around for Merrick. He was half a block away. I couldn't understand why this boy needed money, but I couldn't refuse those eyes. I dug into my pack and pulled out the Sishan coins Esau had given me. I dumped all of them into his palm. Kneeling down to his level, I said, "Share these with your friends, and take a bath, okay?" A joyful expression lit his face. "Thank—" Before he could finish, we were engulfed by a strong stench as the others surrounded us. They grabbed my arms, pulled at my clothes, and yanked on my backpack. I saw the boy pocket the coins and slid out of the melee between the other's legs. The putrid smell of so many unwashed bodies made me gag. Lovely lady, filled my ears until their words were cut off by the clatter of hooves on the cobblestones.
"Get away from her," Cahill yelled.
He brandished his sword in the air.
"Go, or I'll cut you in half."
In a heartbeat, the crowd disappeared.
"Are you all right?" Cahill asked.
"Yes." I smoothed my hair and reshouldered my pack. "What was that about?"
"Beggars. Filthy street rats."
A look of disgust darkened his face.
"It was your fault.
If you hadn't given them money, they would have left you alone.
Beggars?
My confusion seemed to amaze Cahill. Surely you know what beggars are.
When I didn't answer, he continued.
They don't work. They live on the streets. They beg for money for food. You had to see them in Ixia, he said with frustration.
No. Everyone in Ixia has a job. Basic necessities are provided to all by the commander's military.
How does he pay for it?
Before I could answer, Cahill's shoulders drooped.
With my uncle's money. He has probably drained the treasury dry.
I bit back my reply. As far as I was concerned, better to have the money helping people than covering the floor of some treasury.
Come on.
Cahill took his foot out of the stirrup, reached down, and held out his hand.
We need to catch up to the others.
On the horse? I asked.
Don't tell me they don't have horses in the north.
Not for me, I said as I placed my foot in the stirrup and grabbed his arm. He pulled me into the saddle. I sat behind him, not sure what to do with my arms.
Cahill turned slightly. For who, then?
The commander, generals, and high-ranking officers.
Cavalry? Cahill asked.
He was fishing for information. I suppressed a sigh. Not that I saw. The truth, but I ceased to care if he believed me or not. Cahill craned his head around and studied my face. A wave of heat enveloped me. I suddenly felt too close to him. His eyes sparked a bluish-green color like the water in the sunlight. And I found myself wondering why he wore a beard in such a hot climate.
I imagined Cahill without his beard. He would look younger, and it would be easier to see his smooth, tanned skin and hawk-like nose.
When he turned back, I shook my head. I wanted nothing more to do with him.
Hold on, he said.
Then he clicked his tongue. The horse began to move. I clutched Cahill's waist as I bounced in the saddle. The ground seemed so far down and looked so hard. I fought to keep my balance as we caught up to his men. When we passed them, I relaxed, assuming he would stop and let me off. But we kept going, and the men ran behind. As we wound our way through the citadel, I focused on the horse beneath me, trying to find a rhythm for my body to match the horse's, like Cahill seemed to be doing. He crouched above the saddle while my legs pounded the leather. I concentrated on the horse's movement and suddenly found myself looking out of the horse's eyes. The road wrapped around like I was inside a bubble. I could see far forward as well as to each side, and almost all the way behind. The horse was hot and tired, and he wondered why there were two people on his back. Peppermint Man was the only one who usually rode him, but sometimes Straw Boy took him out for exercise back home. He longed for his cool, quiet stall filled with hay and a bucket of water. Water soon, I thought to the horse. I hoped.
What's your name? I asked.
Topaz.
I marveled at our communication. Contact with other animals had only given me a glimpse through their eyes and a hint of their desires. I never had an actual conversation with an animal before. My back began to ache.
Smoother? I asked.
Topaz changed his gait. Cahill grunted in surprise, but I exhaled with relief. It was as if I rode on a sled down a snow-covered hill. With the new gait, we moved faster, and the men fell farther behind us. Cahill tried to slow Topaz down, but the horse was determined to get his water. We reached the base of a tall tower and stopped in the shade. Cahill jumped down from the horse and inspected Topaz's legs.
I've never seen him do that before. Cahill said.
Do what?
He's a three-gaited horse.
Meaning?
Meaning he knows how to trot, canter, and gallop.
So?
So that wasn't one of his gaits. Some horses can do up to five, but I'm not even sure what that was.
It was smooth and fast. I liked it, I said. Cahill looked at me with suspicion.
How do I get down? I asked.
Left foot in the stirrup. Swing your right leg back around to the left. Then hop off.
I landed on wobbly legs. Topaz swung his head and looked at me. He wanted water. I took one of Topaz's water bags off the saddle and held it open for him. Cahill narrowed his eyes at me, then at his horse.
Is this magician's keep? I asked to distract Cahill.
Yes. The entrance is around the corner. We'll wait for my men, then go in.
It didn't take long for his men to catch up.
We walked to the keep's entrance, where high, scalloped arches framed the massive marble doors. Pink columns supported the arches that spanned two stories. The gates stood open, and we entered without any resistance from the guards. Inside was a courtyard, and beyond that was a collection of buildings. Another city within the city. I couldn't believe the sizes and colors. A patchwork of different colored marble formed the structures. Statues of various animals peeked out from corners and roofs. There were gardens and lawns. My eyes were relieved to view the greenery after enduring the white glare of the citadel's walls. I could see that the keep's thick outer wall formed a rectangle that enclosed the entire area. A tower occupied each of the four corners. Directly opposite the entrance, two figures stood on the steps that led up to the largest structure. Small blocks of peach marble dotted the predominantly yellow-colored building. As we drew closer, I realized the figures were Leaf and a tall woman. She wore a sleeveless, midnight blue dress that fell to her ankles. Her feet were bare, and her white hair was cropped close to her head. Sunlight disappeared into her almost black skin. When we reached the base of the steps, Cahill handed the horse's reins to Marek.
Take him to the stables and then unpack. I'll meet you in the barracks.
Yes, sir, Marek said, turning to go.
Marek, I said, make sure you give Topaz some milk oats. He nodded and moved on. Cahill squeezed my arm.
How do you know about milk oats?
I thought fast. Cahill, I've been traveling with you for over a week. I've helped feed him. True to a point, but I didn't think it would be a good idea to tell Cahill that his horse had asked me for some milk oats. And I was certain he didn't want to know that his own horse called him Peppermint Man.
You're lying. Milk oats are a special treat that the stable master bakes. He feeds them to the horses, no one else.
I opened my mouth to reply, but a strident voice interrupted.
Cahill, is something wrong?
Together we glanced at the woman. She and Leaf were descending toward us.
Nothing's wrong, Cahill said.
They stopped a few steps above us.
Is this her? The woman asked.
Yes, First Magician, Cahill said.
Are you certain about her allegiance to Ixia? She asked.
Yes. She carries an Ixian uniform and has Ixian coins, Cahill said.
Her loyalty and longing for Ixia tastes thick like a rancid soup, Leaf said.
The woman stepped closer to me. I looked into her amber eyes. They were shaped like a snow cat's and were just as lethal. Her gaze expanded, encompassing me, and my world disappeared as the ground turned to rippling amber liquid. I began to sink. Something circled my ankles and then pulled me under the surface. My clothes were stripped away, then my skin, then my muscles. My bones dissolved until there was nothing left but my soul. Chapter 10. Something sharp scratched my soul, searching for vulnerable spots. I pushed away the intrusive object and began to build a wall of defense in my mind. This magician would not reach me. Bricks formed and stacked, but they crumbled at the edges. Holes drilled through as I struggled to stay ahead of First Magician. I poured all my strength into that wall. I patched the holes. I added another wall within the first. But the bricks disintegrated and collapsed. Damn it! No! I scrambled for a while, but it was just a matter of time. In the end, I let the wall dissolve. But with a sudden rush of energy, I created a curtain of green-veined marble, cutting her off. I pressed myself to the smooth stone and held on with all my might. Exhaustion pulled at my mind. In pure desperation, I used the last of my power, calling for help. The marble transformed into a statue of Valak. He looked at me in concern. Help, I said. He wrapped his strong arms around me, pulling me close to his chest. Anything, love? With nothing left, I clung to him as darkness descended. I awoke in a narrow room, my head throbbing. Looking up at the ceiling, I realized that I was on a bed. It had been pushed against a wall under an open window. When I moved to sit up, my stiff legs protested.
I felt raw and violated as though someone had scrubbed off my skin. My throat blazed with thirst. A pitcher of water sweated on a night table, an empty glass beside it. I poured a large drink and downed the cool liquid in 3 gulps. Feeling a little better, I examined the room. An armoire stood along the opposite wall with a full-length mirror on the right and a doorway on the left. Cahill appeared in the doorway.
I thought I heard you.
What happened? I asked.
First magician tried to read your mind, Cahill said.
He looked embarrassed.
She was extremely annoyed by your resistance. But she did say you weren't a spy.
Peachy. Sarcasm rendered my voice sharp. I crossed my arms over my chest. How did I get here? Splotches of red spread on his cheeks.
I carried you.
I hugged myself. The thought of being touched by him made my skin crawl. Why did you stay?
I wanted to make sure you were all right.
Now you're concerned about me? I find that hard to believe. I stood on sore legs. They felt as if I had run too many laps, and my lower back ached. Where am I?
In the students' quarters, apprentice wing. You've been assigned these rooms.
Cahill retreated into the other room. I followed him into a small sitting area with a large desk, a couch, table and chairs, and a marble fireplace. The walls were made of light green marble. My pack rested on the table with my bow. There was another door. I crossed the room and opened it. Beyond the threshold was a garden courtyard with trees and statues. Through them I could see the setting sun. I stepped outside, glancing around. My rooms were at the end of a long, one-story building. No one was in sight. Cahill joined me outside.
The students will be back at the start of the cooling season.
He pointed to a path.
That leads to the dining hall and classrooms. Want me to give you a tour?
No, I said, going back into the sitting room. I turned around in the doorway. I want you and your toy soldiers to leave me the hell alone. Now you know I'm not a spy. Stay the hell away from me. I closed the door and locked it, leaving Cahill outside. Just to be safe, I wedged a chair under the doorknob. I curled up on the bed. The desire to go home racked my body. Home to Valak. To his strength and his love. Just that brief contact with him made me miss him even more. His absence left an emptiness that burned deep inside me. I wanted to leave Cydia. I had gained enough control of my magic to avoid a flameout. I didn't need to be here with these horrible people. All I had to do was head north, and I would reach Ixia's border. I planned the journey in my mind, making a list of provisions, and even considered horse-napping Topaz to make my escape. When the room grew dark, I fell asleep. When the sun woke me, I rolled onto my other side, weighed my chances of escaping the keep without anyone knowing, and realized I knew nothing of the layout of the keep. I could make a reconnaissance of the area, but I had no desire to see anyone or be seen. So I stayed in bed all day and went back to sleep that night. Another day passed. Someone rattled the doorknob, then knocked, calling out to me. I shouted for them to go away, and was content when they did. Eventually, I lay in a stupor. My mind floated and reached some creatures in the garden. I flinched away from even that light contact, seeking a peaceful place. Then I found Topaz. Peppermint Man had come to visit, but the horse wondered where Lavender Lady was. I saw a picture of me in Topaz's mind. Lavender Lady must be the name he had given me. It was funny that Topaz called me Lavender Lady. Traveling with Cahill left little time for bathing, but I had managed to find some privacy to freshen up and apply a few drops of my mother's lavender perfume.
Go smooth and fast, Topaz thought.
Would you take me far away to the north? I asked.
Not without Peppermint Man. Smooth and fast with you both. I am strong.
You are very strong. Perhaps I'll stay with you.
No, you won't, Yelena. You've sulked enough,
Iris's voice said in my mind. Her contact was like a thick, cool salve rubbed on an open wound. I'm not sulking.
Then what would you call it?
Iris demanded with annoyance. Protecting myself. She laughed.
From what? Rose barely got through.
Rose?
Rose Featherstone, first magician, and she's been in a rage ever since. You've weathered worse things, Yelena. What's the real problem?
I felt helpless and alone with no one to watch my back. But I buried that thought deep, unwilling to share it with Iris. Instead, I ignored her question. Knowing my mentor was back, I rallied. She was the only person I could trust in the keep.
I'm coming with some food. You will let me in, and you will eat, Iris ordered.
Food? Topaz thought hopefully. Apple? Peppermints?
I smiled. Later. My stomach grumbled. As I moved to sit on the edge of the bed, a wave of dizziness overcame me. I had lost track of the days, and I was weak from hunger. Iris came as promised, carrying a tray laden with fruit and cold meats. She also brought a pitcher of pineapple juice and some cakes. As I ate, she told me about her trip to May's home. May was the last of the kidnapped girls to find her lost family.
5 sisters just like her, Iris said, shaking her head.
I grinned, imagining May's homecoming. 6 girls squealing with delight, laughing and crying as they all talked at once.
Their beleaguered father wanted me to test all the girls for magical potential. May has some, but I want her to wait another year before coming to the school. The others were still too young.
Iris poured 2 cups of juice.
I had to cut my visit short when I felt your call for help.
When Rose was invading?
Yes. I was too far away to assist you, but it seems like you managed on your own.
Valak helped me, I said.
That's impossible. I couldn't reach you. Valak's not a magician.
But he was there, and I drew on his strength. Unwilling to believe me, Iris shook her head. I thought about how Iris had found me in the north. You felt my power when I was in Ixia, I said. It's the same distance for Valak to reach me. She shook her head again.
Valak is resistant to magic, so I think you used his image as a shield against Rose. When I felt you last year, you had no control over your powers. Uncontrolled bursts of magic cause ripples in the power source. All magicians anywhere in the world can feel that, but only master magicians will know from which direction it comes.
That worried me. You felt my call for help when you were at May's home, though. Was I out of control to be able to reach you at that distance? Loss of control led to flame out, which led to death for the magician and damaged the power source for all magicians. She looked startled.
No.
She frowned and stared at the wall, considering.
Yelena, what have you been doing with your magic since I left you?
I told her about the ambush, the escape, and the truce with Cahill.
So you put all of Cahill's men into a deep sleep? She asked.
Well, there were only 12. Did I do something wrong? Have I broken your ethical code? There was so much I didn't know about magic. Iris snorted, reading my mind.
And you wanted to run away with a horse.
Better than staying here with Cahill and Leaf, I said aloud.
Those 2.
Iris frowned again.
The master magicians had a discussion with both of them. Rose is furious that they misled her about you. Cahill actually had the audacity to demand a council session in the middle of the hot season. He'll just have to wait until the cooling season. Perhaps he'll get on the agenda, or perhaps not.
Iris shrugged, seeming unconcerned. Would the Sissians go to war for Cahill? I asked.
We have no quarrel with the North, but no love for them either. The council has been waiting for Cahill to mature. If he develops the charisma and strong leadership abilities, his plans to take back Ixia may be supported by the council.
She cocked her head to the side as if considering the prospect of going to war.
The trade treaty is the first official contact we've had with Ixia in 15 years, she explained. It's a good beginning. We have always been worried that Commander Ambrose would try to take over Citia as he did in the north. But he seems content.
Would a Sissian army prevail against the North?
What do you think?
Citia would have a difficult time. The commander's men are loyal, dedicated, and well-trained,
To lose a battle, they would either need to be vastly outnumbered or be vastly outsmarted.
Iris nodded. A campaign against them would have to be launched with the utmost care, which is why the Council is waiting. But that is not my concern today. My priority is to teach you magic and discover your specialty. You're stronger than I thought, Yelena. Putting 12 men to sleep is no easy task. And having a conversation with a horse.
Iris pulled her hair back from her face and held it behind her head.
If I hadn't been listening in, I wouldn't have believed you.
Iris rose and began to pile the dishes onto the tray.
What you did to Cahill's men would normally be considered a breach of the ethical code, but you acted in self-defense, so it was acceptable. She paused for a moment. What Rose did to you was a clear violation of our ethics, but she thought you were a spy. The code doesn't apply to spies. All Sishians are united in their intolerance for espionage. The commander gained power by infiltrating the monarchy and using assassination, so Sitya worries when a spy is uncovered that the commander is trying to collect enough information to launch another takeover.
Picking up the tray of dirty plates, Iris said, "Tomorrow I will show you the keep and start your training. There are candles and flint in the armor if you need a light, and there's firewood behind the building for when it gets cold. I've assigned you to the apprentices' wing because you're too old for the first year's barracks, and I think by the start of school you'll be ready to join the apprentice class." What's the apprentice class?
The keep has a 5-year curriculum. Students start the program about a year after they reach maturity. Usually around the age of 14, their magic has grown to a point where they can direct it. Each year of the Keep's curriculum has a title. First year, novice, junior, senior, and apprentice. You'll be at the apprentice level, but your schooling will be different since you need to learn about our history and government.
Iris shook her head.
I'll figure it out before classes start. You'll probably be with students from different levels, depending on the subject. But don't worry about that now. Why don't you unpack and make yourself at home?
Her words reminded me that I had something for her in my pack. Iris, wait a moment, I said before she could leave. My mother sent you some perfume. I dug into my bag. By some stroke of luck, the bottles hadn't been damaged during the trip to the Citadel. I gave Iris the appleberry perfume and put my bottle of lavender on the table. Iris thanked me and left. After she was gone, the room felt empty. Taking everything out of my backpack, I hung my old uniform in the armoire and decorated the table with the Valmer statue I had bought for Valak. But the room still seemed bare. I would ask Iris to exchange my Ixian money. Perhaps I could purchase a few things to brighten up the place. I found Esau's field guide at the bottom of my pack. Taking a candle into the bedroom, I read his book until my eyes grew heavy. From his vast notes, it seemed that almost every plant and tree in the jungle had a reason for existing. I caught myself wishing there was a page in his guide that had my picture on it, with the reason for my existence written underneath in Esau's neat hand. In the morning, Iris scrunched up her nose when she entered my rooms.
"Perhaps I'll show you the bathhouse first. We'll send your clothes to the laundry and get you some fresh ones."
I laughed. "Bad?"
"Yes."
Iris and I went to another marble building with blue columns all around. The bathhouse had separate pools for men and women. Washing the road grime from my skin felt wonderful. The laundry mistress took my tattered and stained clothes. Nutty's outfit, my white shirt and black pants, all needed mending. I borrowed a light green cotton tunic and khaki-colored pants. Iris told me the keep had no particular dress code for classes and everyday events, but special functions required an apprentice robe. After I combed and plaited my hair, we walked to the dining room for breakfast. Gazing around the keep, I could see a pattern in the inner layout. Paths and gardens wound their way past marble buildings of various size and shape. Barracks and student housing ringed the main campus. The stables, laundry, and kennels lined the back wall of the keep. Horses grazed in a large, fenced pasture next to an oval training yard. I asked Iris about the four towers.
The master magicians live in them.
She pointed to the one in the northwest corner. That one is mine. The one in the northeast corner near the stables is Zitora Cowan's, third magician. The southwest one is Rose Featherstone's, and the southeast one is Bane Bloodgood's, second magician.
What if you have more than four masters?
In the history of the Magician's Keep, we have never had more than four. Less, yes, but never more. It would be a wonderful problem to have. The towers are huge, so there would be plenty of room to share. She smiled.
Three people sat in the dining room. Rows and rows of empty tables lined the long room.
When school starts, these tables will be filled with students. Teachers and magicians. Everyone eats here, Iris explained.
She introduced me to the two men and one woman eating breakfast. Gardeners on break, they were just a small part of the vast force needed to tend the landscaping. We ate. I pocketed an apple for Topaz, and Iris took me to her chambers. After climbing what seemed like a million steps and passing 10 levels of rooms, we emerged at the top. The circular room's windows stretched from floor to ceiling. Curtains, long and lacy, blew in the hot breeze. Colorful cushions and couches in blues, purples, and silver decorated the bright area. The place was ringed with bookshelves, and the air held a fresh citrus scent.
My meditation room, Iris said. The perfect environment to draw power and to learn.
I walked around, looking outside. She had a magnificent view of the keep, and, through the northeast-facing windows, I could see rolling green hills pockmarked with small villages.
That's part of the Featherstone clan's lands, Iris said, following my gaze.
She gestured to the center of the room.
Sit down. Let's begin.
Iris sat on a purple cushion, crossing her legs. I perched on a blue pillow across from her. But my bow...
You won't need your bow. I'll teach you how to draw your power without relying on physical contact. The power source surrounds the world like a blanket. You have the ability to take a thread from this cloth, pull it into your body, and use it. But don't take too much, or you'll bunch up the blanket, warping the source and leaving some areas bare and others with too much power. It's rumored that there are places where there are holes in the blanket, areas of no power, but I haven't found any.
I felt her power spread from her like a bubble. She raised her hand and said,
Veneta den.
The power slammed into me. My muscles froze solid. I stared at her in a growing panic.
Push it away, she said.
I considered my brick wall, but knew it was no match for her strength. Once again, I drew down my marble curtain and severed the flow of power. My muscles relaxed.
Very good, she said. I took a line of power and shaped it into a ball. Then, using a word and a gesture, I directed it toward you. We teach the students words and gestures for learning purposes, but really you can use anything you want. It just helps focus the power. And after a while you won't need to use the words to perform the magic. It becomes instinctive. Now your turn.
But I don't know how to pull a thread of power. I just concentrate on the feel of my bow's wood and then my mind somehow detaches and I project it out to other minds. Why does that work?
The ability to read thoughts is another thread of power linking two minds, forging a connection. Once the link is made, it remains there and reconnecting is easy. For example, consider the link between us, and between you and Topaz.
And Valak, I said.
Yes, Valak too. Although with his immunity to magic, I think your link with him must be on a subconscious level. Have you ever read his thoughts?
No, but I haven't tried. Somehow I always knew what he was feeling.
A survival instinct. That makes sense, considering his position in Ixia, and since he decided if you would live or die on a daily basis.
That survival instinct saved me a few times, I said, remembering my troubles in Ixia. I would find myself in a tight spot, and suddenly it seemed another person had taken control of my body and impossible things would happen.
Yes, but now you have control, and you can make those things happen.
I'm not so sure.
Iris raised her hand. Enough of that. Now concentrate. Feel the power. Pull it to you and hold it. I took a deep breath and closed my eyes for good measure. Feeling a little silly, I focused on the air around me, trying to sense the blanket of power. For a while, nothing happened. Then I felt the air thicken and press against my skin. I willed the magic to gather closer. Once the pressure grew intense, I opened my eyes. Iris watched me.
When you release it toward me, think of what you want the power to do. A word or gesture will help and can be used as a shortcut for the next time.
I pushed the power and said, "Over." For a moment, nothing happened. Then Iris's eyes widened in shock, and she fell over. I ran to her. "I'm sorry." She peered up at me.
"That was odd."
"Odd how?"
"Instead of pushing me over, your magic invaded my mind, giving me a mental command to fall."
Iris settled herself back on the pillow.
"Try again, but this time think of the power as a physical object like a wall, and direct it toward me."
I followed her directions, but the results were the same.
"It's an unorthodox method, but it works."
Iris tucked a loose strand of hair behind her ear.
"Let's work on your defenses. I want you to deflect my power before it can affect you."
In a blur of motion, she aimed a ball of energy toward me.
"Teetotal!"
I jumped back and put my hands up, but I wasn't fast enough. My world spun. Streaks of color swirled around me before I could position my defenses. I was flat on my back, looking up at the sloped ceiling of the tower. An owl slept on a nest in the rafters.
"You need to keep your defenses up at all times," Iris said. "You don't want to be caught unaware." "But then again..."
Iris smoothed her shirt.
"You kept Rose from going deep into your mind."
I shied away from that subject. "What does teetotal mean?" I asked.
"It's a nonsense word," Iris said. "I made it up. No sense alerting you to what I plan to do. I use those words for attacks and defensive moves, but for practical matters like fire and light, I use real words."
"I can make fire?"
"If you're strong enough. But it's tiring work. Using magic is draining, some types more than others. You seem to be able to connect with other minds without a lot of effort," Iris said. "Perhaps that is your specialty."
"What do you mean by specialty?"
"Some magicians can only do certain things. We have magicians who can heal physical injuries and others who can help with mental trauma. Some can move large objects like statues, while others can light fires with minimal effort."
Iris played with the tassels on her cushion.
"Sometimes you'll find someone who can do two or three things, or a hybrid talent like Leaf who can sense a person's soul. For you, we've discovered that not only can you read minds, but you can also influence a person's or animal's actions. A rare talent. That's two abilities."
"Is that the limit?" I asked.
"No. Master magicians can do everything."
"So why is Rose called first magician and you're fourth?" Iris gave me a tired smile.
"Rose is stronger than I am. We can both light fires. While I can only make a campfire, she has the ability to set a two-story structure ablaze."
I thought about what she had said. If a magician only has one talent, what do they do when they finish their training?
"We assign magicians to different towns and cities depending on what is needed. We try to have a healer in every town at all times. Other magicians cover several towns, traveling from place to place to help with projects."
"What would I do?" I asked, wondering if a useful place for me existed. But at the same time, I wasn't sure if I wanted a useful place in Citya.
Iris laughed. "It's too soon to tell. For now, you need to practice collecting power and using it, and practice keeping up your defenses."
"How do I keep my wall up without draining myself?"
"I imagine my defensive wall, which resembles this tower room. I make it solid and strong, and then I make it translucent so I can see out of it, and then I don't think about it anymore. But when magic is directed toward me, my barrier solidifies and deflects the attack before my consciousness is even fully aware of it.
I followed her instructions and created an invisible barrier in my mind. Iris tested it at unexpected times throughout the morning, and it held. The rest of the time I practiced gathering magic, but no matter how hard I tried, my magic could only affect two things: Iris and the owl sleeping in the rafters. Iris's patience amazed me, and for the first time since coming to Citya, I felt hopeful that mastering my powers might be within my abilities.
"That was a good start," Iris said as lunchtime neared. "Go eat, and then rest this afternoon. We'll work in the mornings, and you can practice and study at night. But tonight you need to see the stable master and pick out a horse."
Did I hear her right? A horse?
Yes. All magicians have horses. Occasionally you'll be needed somewhere fast. I had to leave my horse, Silk, here during my mission in Ixia. When you called for help, I had to borrow a horse from May's father. How else do you think I got here so fast?
I hadn't even thought about it. I had been so wrapped up in my own misery at the time. Following Iris's directions, I located the dining hall. I ate lunch, then went back to my rooms where I collapsed into bed and fell asleep.
That night after dinner, I sought out the stable master. I found him at the end of a row of stalls, cleaning a leather saddle. A small, stocky man, his wild brown hair fell past his shoulders like a horse's mane. When he glared up at me, I suppressed my smile.
"What do you want? Can't you see I'm busy?" he asked.
"I'm Yelena. Iris sent me."
"Oh, right, the new student. I don't know why Fourth Magician couldn't wait until everyone's back to start your lessons," he muttered to himself as he put the saddle down. "This way."
He led me past the stable. Topaz poked his head out of his stall. His big brown eyes looked hopeful.
"Apple?" he asked.
Iris had been right. I reconnected with Topaz without any conscious effort. Or had he connected with me? I would have to ask her about that. I gave him the apple in my pocket.
The stable master turned around. "You just made a friend for life," he said, snorting in amusement. "That horse loves food. I never saw a horse take such pleasure in eating before. You can train him to do just about anything for a peppermint."
We went past the hay barn to the pasture. The stable master leaned against the wooden fence. Six horses grazed in the field.
"Pick one out. Makes no difference which one. They're all good. I'll go find your instructor."
"You don't teach?" I asked before he could go.
"Not in the middle of the hot season when everyone but me is gone," he said with annoyance. "I'm too busy mucking out stalls and fixing tack. I said to wait, but Fourth Magician wanted it right away. Good thing one of my instructors came back early."
He mumbled some more as he headed toward the stable. I studied the horses in the field. Three were dark brown like Topaz, two were black, and one was copper with white on the legs from the knees down.
Knowing nothing of horses, I guessed it would come down to color. The copper and white horse looked over at me.
"Like her," Topaz said. "She goes smooth and fast for Lavender Lady."
"How do I get her to come over?" I asked.
"Peppermints."
Topaz looked lovingly at a leather bag hanging near his stall.
The stable master had disappeared. I went back to the stable. Taking out two mints, I gave one to Topaz and took the other back to the field.
"Show Kiki peppermint."
I held out the mint. Kiki glanced at the other horses and then moved toward me. When she came closer, I could see she had a white face with a patch of brown around her left eye. Something about her eyes seemed strange. It wasn't until she sucked the peppermint from my palm that it struck me. Her eyes were blue. I had never seen that before, but that didn't mean much. I knew next to nothing about horses.
"Scratch behind ears," Topaz suggested.
The mare's long copper ears were cocked forward. I stood on tiptoes and rubbed my fingernails behind them. Kiki lowered her head and pressed it against my chest.
"What do you think, girl?" I asked out loud. I couldn't hear her like Topaz.
While rubbing her ears, I pulled a thread of power and projected my mind to her. "Be with me?"
She nudged me with her nose.
"Yes."
I felt Topaz's pleasure.
We go smooth and fast together.
I jumped when I heard the stable master behind me.
Found one already?
He asked. I nodded without looking at him.
That one came from the plains, he said. Good choice.
She must pick another, said a familiar voice.
I turned. Dread curled in my stomach. Cahill stood next to the stable master.
And why would I listen to you? I demanded.
He smirked.
Because I'm your instructor.
Chapter 11.
No, I said. You will not be my instructor.
No choice, said the stable master.
He glanced at Cahill, then me, looking puzzled.
There's no one else, and Fourth Magician insists you start right away.
What if I help you muck out the stables and feed the horses? Will you have time to teach me then? I asked the stable master.
Young lady, you already have plenty to do. You'll be mucking and caring for your own horse, as well as studying your lessons. Cahill's been a stable rat since he was 6. No one, other than me, he grinned, knows more about horses.
I planted my hands on my hips.
Fine. As long as he knows more about horses than he does about people.
Cahill cringed.
Good.
But I keep this horse, I said.
She's a walleye, Cahill said.
A what? I asked.
She has blue eyes. That's bad luck. And she's been bred by the Sandseed clan. Their horses are difficult to train.
Kiki snorted at Cahill.
Mean boy. A silly superstition and an unfair reputation. Cahill, you should know better, the stable master said. She's a perfectly good horse. Whatever's going on between you and Yelena, you'll have to work it out. I've no time to babysit.
With that, he stalked away, once more muttering to himself. Cahill and I glared at each other for a while until Kiki nudged my arm, looking for peppermints. Sorry, girl, no more, I said, holding out my empty hand. She tossed her head and resumed grazing. Cahill stared at me. I crossed my arms over my chest, but they seemed an inadequate barrier between us. I would have preferred thick marble walls. He had exchanged his traveling clothes for a plain white shirt and tight-fitting jodhpurs, but he still wore his black riding boots.
You'll have to live with your decision about the horse. But if you're going to fight me every time I try to teach you something, let me know now, and I won't waste my time.
Iris wants me to learn, so I'll learn. He appeared satisfied.
Good. First lesson starts now.
He climbed over the pasture's fence.
Before you learn how to ride a horse, you must know everything about your horse from the physical to the emotional.
Cahill clicked his tongue at Kiki, and when she ignored him, he approached her.
Just as he came up beside her, she turned, knocking him over with her rump. I bit my lip to keep from laughing.
Every time he tried to get near, Kiki either moved away or bumped into him. His face red with frustration, Cahill finally said,
"The hell with this! I'm getting a halter!"
You hurt her feelings when you said she was bad luck, I explained. She'll cooperate if you apologize.
How would you know? Cahill demanded.
I just know.
You didn't even know how to dismount a horse. I'm not that stupid, he said.
When he started to climb over the fence, I said, I know the same way I knew Topaz wanted milk oats. Cahill stopped, waiting. I sighed. Topaz told me he wanted the treat. I connected with his mind by accident, so I asked him to go smoother because my back hurt. It's the same with Kiki. Cahill pulled at his beard.
The first magician said you had strong magical abilities. I guess I should have known it before, but I was too focused on the spy thing.
He looked at me as if noticing me for the first time. For a second, I thought I witnessed cold calculation slide through Cahill's blue eyes, but it disappeared, leaving me to wonder if I had seen anything at all.
Her name's Kiki? He asked.
I nodded. Cahill returned to Kiki and apologized. I felt a sudden peevish annoyance. He should have been apologizing to me for all the pain he had caused. Spy thing my ass.
Push, mean boy? Kiki asked.
No. Be nice. He's going to teach me to care for you. Cahill gestured for me to join him near Kiki. I clambered over the fence. As Kiki stood her ground, Cahill pointed to and lectured about the different parts of her body. Starting with her muzzle, He didn't stop until he had lifted her right back hoof and showed me the underside.
"Same time tomorrow," he said, ending the lesson. "Meet me in the stable. We'll go over horse care."
Before he could head back to the barn, I stopped him. Now that my annoyance that he was my instructor was gone, I wondered why he was here. "Why are you teaching me? I thought your campaign for the Ixion throne would take up most of your time."
Well aware of how I felt about his quest, Cahill studied me, seeking for signs of sarcasm. "Until I receive the full support of the Sishan Council, I can only do so much," he said. "Besides, I need money to pay for my expenses. Most of my men are employed at the keep as guards or gardeners, depending on what's needed."
He wiped his hands on his pants, staring at the horses in the pasture.
"When the keep is on hiatus during the hot season, I focus all my efforts on gathering support. This season, I thought I would finally get the council's backing."